Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it feel like to live as a black face in a white space? College campuses, known as PWIs for predominantly white institutions, can be challenging places for students of color to explore their identities, especially when they find themselves surrounded by fellow students who, with or without malicious intentions, simply don't get it. The new feature film, Dear White People, uses humor to explore those experiences and to reveal the very complex realities of racial identity in America and the ways in which it can define, limit, or enrich us. It's set on the campus of the fictitious Ivy League school called Winchester University, where four main characters find themselves engaged in a search for their authentic selves in an environment where the dominant culture is that of affluent whites. Texas native Justin Simeon wrote, directed, and co-produced Dear White People on a shoestring budget. The whole thing was shot over just 19 days. And he went on to win the Special Jury Award at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival and a spot on Variety Magazine's coveted 10 Directors to Watch list. The film is out in theaters now, and we are delighted to welcome Justin Simeon to our studio. Justin, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me here.
What was college like for you, and did you understand at the time that your own explorations of your identity were complicated by the environment you were doing them in?
Yeah, I mean, college for me was a bit of a culture shock, I must say, because I went to a very untraditional high school. I went to the High School for the Performing Visual Arts in Houston, Texas. And, you know, HSPVA, while it also sort of had, you know, I think any place where you have a diverse group of people, there are going to be issues, you know, under the surface regarding race. But by and large, it was this very diverse place where you were very much encouraged to sort of look into the eyes of the other and see things through each other's perspectives and sort of, you know, tell stories about your own experiences and be open to other people's stories. And it was just, you know, we were all the freaks and the geeks, you know, so there.
But
so
in
the,
one place. So it
but in one
matter.
Place. Yeah. So, you know, those traditional sort of social mores and structures didn't really apply to us. And so to go from there to a more, you know, traditional, I guess, educational setting where, you know, there are kind of hardwired cliques and there are different groupings of people. And I did encounter people who, you know, were not only, you know, white, but had never really interfaced with a person of color for an extended period of time before. So for me, you know, going to Chapman University, which is where I went, had a great education in film there. It's in Orange County in a town called Old Town Orange. And, you know, there's not
but
a lot.
But that speaks volumes right there.
Yeah. And there's just not a lot of black folks there. and so, you know, just finding myself having to explain things like why I couldn't necessarily play basketball or, you know, why I had no interest in sort of like the latest, you know, black dance craze at the time and getting people not to touch my hair and looking for a person who could cut black hair. And just sort of those issues, you know, that kind of came up pretty soon after I started college.
I thought in the film it was really interesting because there are some white characters that are just awful, like they're kind of blatantly racist. But then there are others who feel like they're doing the right thing and still step into, you know, like blunder in ways that are just cringeworthy. And in the film, we see some of the characters, including Lionel, and we'll talk about him in a minute, actually visibly reacting. But I'm wondering if that's the sort of thing that when you experience these blunders, you have to make a decision every time. Like, am I going to show that that just really got under my skin, or am I just going to just ignore it and move on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because the movie is called Dear White People, and it sort of takes its name from a radio show within the world of the film that Samantha White, a character, has to sort of call white people out on these things, often referred to as microaggressions. You know, everything from sort of assuming that you're above racism because you have a black friend, or, you know, marveling at how a black person can be articulate, or touching a black person's hair without asking. These kinds of things she calls out, and you know, ultimately, it's the controversy over that show that really kind of thrusts the narrative. But I actually think of it more so from the perspectives of the black students, because honestly, there's no way to avoid the faux pas. You know, it's the time that we're in. We're kind of, you know, particularly this idea of millennials, you know, kind of seeing race less than perhaps the generations before them. We're going to get all mixed up and we're going to have these conversations and we're going to step on each other's toes. And that's just sort of going to happen. But given that that's the America that we live in, I wanted to explore the experiences from the point of view of these people of color. And yeah, they struggle with, should I say something? Or, you know, this idea of, should I rebel against or should I conform to, you know, sort of the ideas that people have about me, is it tends to be the, you know, the identity crisis that they're all having.
The generational differences are really explored in an interesting way. And you have the character of Troy, who is this, like, golden boy. Mm. Literally, he's just, like, the most attractive actor ever. And he is in not really in conflict with his father, but his father is from a different generation and has these incredibly exacting standards based on a lot of hardships that he had as a young man and continues to feel like his career, although he's very successful, he feels like he's been held back by the fact that he's black.
Right.
And it's an interesting kind of generational question. Can you talk about, has the film been sort of responded to in different ways depending on the age of the audience?
I think so, yeah, because I think the way blackness, you know, in air quotes, was defined by the generation before this one was different. And I think racism in a lot of ways has gone from being incredibly overt and you know, having a very obvious targets in which we had to fight to being covert and sort of being more difficult to sniff out. And I think particularly now, you know, kids are growing up with social media and just sort of a multitude of influences across racial lines and are beginning to sort of figure out how to define themselves in many different ways. And so, yeah, there is sort of a generational gap in terms of what it feels like to be a person of color in this country. But, you know, particularly with Troy, what I wanted to sort of get into is the ways in which we tend to perpetuate, you know, the sort of old battles of the ones that came before us and this pressure to sort of make good on all the progress that they've done. And, you know, there really is this sense, you know, being a black man of wanting to sort of live up to the highest possible ideal of black masculinity.
That's a lot of pressure.
It's a ton of pressure. And I also wanted to sort of talk about, you know, this idea, a lot of people who say, oh, we're colorblind and we're past racism and we're post-racial and all this, because, you know.
Is it only white people who say that?
I think it's primarily just because I think being a person of color, you just innately know that that's not true. Mm-hmm. But there are some black people who say, yeah, I don't see racism, again, because racism is more covert. But I wanted to get into, you know, this comparison because there are sort of two legacy kids that are the focus of the narrative. There's Troy, whose father ended up being dean of the school, and there's Kurt, whose father ended up being president of the school. And I kind of wanted to talk about the differences between two men who were sort of born with similar resources, similar access to education, and the difference in their lives just by way, you know, just by the merit of the color of their skin. Because a lot of times we talk about, well, it is possible for African Americans to achieve success in this country. And because that is so, people like to say, well, then there's no racism. But that's not true at all. You know, Troy is in every way affected by being a person of color in ways that Kurt, it never even has to occur to Kurt. He doesn't have to walk through the world with this sort of pressure of the generation before him of having to make good and having to, you know, live his life and play a certain role in the same way that Troy does.
Because there aren't enough films like this, Justin, that try to take sort of a clear-eyed view at the very complex issues involved with race and racial identity in this country, did you worry that people who would come to see this film would say, well, like, there's nothing here about poverty and there's nothing here about, you know, urban act, you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Like every possible issue that could affect, you know, a black millennial, you can't possibly treat that in this film.
No. And honestly, that's sort of, you know, that's the curse that every black filmmaker struggles with, you know, when you're trying to do something that's sort of outside of the mainstream. You know, this is a movie that I think is entertaining and it's funny and people are enjoying it, but I didn't make this movie to just, you know, get a check or to sort of, you know, be a blockbuster kind of thing. I made this movie to say something new about the experience of being a person of color and to say something new about identity. And naturally, like, you know, I have to focus the narrative on only a few things. And I think this happens, just like you said, because there are so few, and it's such a rare opportunity for a person of color to see their experiences presented in a film and oftentimes on television and any other aspects of the culture, that we do feel very disappointed when our very specific black experience is not included. But I think that's really, it speaks to the fact that we just need more. We need more, you know?
It is funny that we talk about the black experience in America as if there's one.
Of course. Right? Yeah. I mean, part of what my movie is saying is that there isn't a monolithic experience to be had. And, you know, there is as many black experiences as there are black people. And I think, you know, people of color tend to know that just innately. But I think oftentimes we're sort of, you know, subjected to presumptions about us by, you know, white people who just assume that we are kind of all having the same experiences or listen to the same music or have the same political views or et cetera. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been asked to sort of on the spot just blindly defend whatever, you know, President Obama has done with the assumption that, like, you know, I would never possibly analyze it, you know, through any other lens than the fact that I'm like, black.
You're
and he's
black, right? So,
yeah. So go, you know.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Justin Simeon. His new feature film, Dear White People, is open in theaters. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with filmmaker Justin Simeon.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
Well, on behalf of all the colored folks in the room, let me apologize to all the better qualified white students whose place we're taking up.
No, it's fine. We're okay.
I'm sorry, did you get lost? Bichet's that way.
Oh, I know where it is. I'm actually supposed to eat there. Yeah, it's just this is the only dining hall that you can actually get yourself some chicken and waffles. Look, you're Dear White People, right? It's funny. It's funny stuff. It really is. How have we not staffed you yet?
Oh, me? Oh, what? On Pastiche, your uninspired humor magazine?
It's actually much more than just a magazine, sweetheart. SNL staff is basically half Lampoon, half Pastiche. Same goes for the network comedies.
And what gives you Clubhouse kids the right to come to our dining hall? You don't live here.
Sam, what are you doing?
So you can't eat here.
Chill, Sam. Damn, all right? Let the man eat.
Got this.
Got this. Look, who are you to throw me out?
Oh, well, I think I'm head of this house. And I'm doing things my way.
That is a scene from the feature film Dear White People. You heard the dining hall of a traditionally all-black dorm with Tessa Thompson as Sam White and Kyle Gallner as Kurt Fletcher. My guest is the filmmaker, Justin Simeon, and Dear White People is open now in theaters. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Sam is a fascinating character because she wants to, it seems like she definitely wants to be provocative. She wants to explore these things that frustrate her about her identity and about the assumptions people make about her based on her identity. But then it gets bigger than she is, and she's left realizing that, you know, even deciding that you're going to be a provocateur can be something that gets out of your control.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as I said before, the film ultimately, it's about the relationship between identity and self and what happens when one of the two of those things is perhaps weighted, you know, inappropriately. And for Sam, I wanted you to meet Sam and just kind of be energized by her persona. And I wanted the characters in the world of the film to be so excited by her persona. And when that persona outgrows her and begins to sort of force her to deny certain elements of who she really is, you know, see what she would do in that situation. I very much saw Sam as, you know, I saw Sam as a lot of different things. And Tessa and I talked a lot about different reference points for Sam. But one of the things that one of the more interesting pieces to me about the Civil Rights story is when you look at what happened to Malcolm after he came back from Egypt, you know, after he sort of decided that, you know what, actually, I think we are all one. And he began to sort of disagree with the Nation of Islam, and the persona of Malcolm X, you know, was one that became an ill fit for him and for the Nation of Islam. And I think that that's such an interesting story. I love the stories about Martin Luther King before he became Martin Luther King, where they, you know, they approached him about being the face for the civil rights movement. Hackman and the hesitancy that he felt about taking on, you know, obviously it was so meaningful to him and to both of them, but to take on, you know, the weight of being an icon, you know, was something that they consciously both had to deal with and struggle with. And I thought that was such an interesting aspect of, you know, the Black experience, particularly where there's all of this pressure to sort of be authentically Black and to keep it real and to, you know, and to sort of, you know, almost perpetrate the expectations that people have around you, even when they're positive.
Do you feel like you have to make a decision between being an activist and an artist to do either one right?
Wow. I think I had to, because I think that I was born to be a storyteller. I mean, I really believe that. In terms of activism, I've never felt that call on my life, you know. And I suppose art is a form of activism, but it doesn't, you know, as an artist, I don't necessarily have the expertise, you know, to sort of organize a group of people in a specific way, you know, to make specific social change. But as an artist, I'm very comfortable holding the mirror up. I'm very comfortable raising the questions. I'm very comfortable sort of, you know, in the confines of a narrative, sort of exploring this thing and trying to be honest about it.
With regard to that honesty, the other thing that people who haven't seen the film yet may not realize is that your characters all represent sort of a segment of Black culture and also individuals within that segment. They're all pretty complicated people, and there's no one who is sort of entirely reliable as a lens on their own lives. There's no one who doesn't make some mistakes. There's no one who isn't entirely formed, meaning imperfect.
Yeah, they all make compromises that, you know, make us uncomfortable, and they all do things that make us cheer. And that's just that's the truth, isn't it, of, you know, being a human being, is that and I felt like there was just, I just really hate it, particularly when movies about race, when, you know, Black people are either sort of portrayed as, you know, this tragic hero, or the kind of, you know, flawless, you know, hero that sort of rises above everything, because neither of those things is true, and neither of those things is what it actually looks like. And I thought, some, you know, telling stories about what the middle looks like would be a more truthful thing to do. I often reference Do the Right Thing, you know, when people ask me about the complexity of the characters, because that wasn't, you know, certainly something I was influenced by. You know, you go into a movie called Do the Right Thing, and you're waiting for 2 hours to be told by the movie what the right thing to do is. And the brilliant thing about it is that you can hardly say who did the right thing at any given point in that film. And all of the characters did the right thing, and they all did the wrong thing at a certain point. And that's the truth about how racial violence occurs in America. You know, it's not so cut and dry. It's not so black and white. And only when we can sort of look at a thing from an honest perspective do I think we can actually have a meaningful conversation about it.
There's some really interesting choices that you made regarding shots in the film. There are places where we see a character in profile and they don't have what is called nose room, meaning that there's more space behind their heads than in front of their heads in the frame. There are times when people are really framed in a way that feels very claustrophobic when the dean and the university president are arguing. Can you talk about how that works into what you're trying to say with these stories?
Well, I mean, you know, that's just sort of me as a filmmaker. I itch when I see anything that looks terribly conventional. Mm-hmm. You know, I really loathe sort of shooting things in the sort of typical wide shot, medium shot, close-up, coverage, insert.
All the stuff you were taught at film school.
Yeah, basically, you know. I much more am interested in, you know, first of all, just as a film goer, I'm interested in filmmakers that have a very specific point of view and a specific way of seeing the world around them. And, you know, for me, when I go in to sort of decide how I'm going to shoot a scene, it's important for me to distill the scene down into what it's really, really about, and then find the most visually interesting way to say that, you know, to say it almost without saying anything. How can I, you know, in a certain scene, give a sense that a person is sort of boxed in by their beautiful and ornate and popular identity? You know, how can I show the hollowness of an identity? How can I show the vulnerability of a character? I start to ask myself those kinds of questions, and really, you know, if my visual style is anything that can even be determined with one film yet, it's really that I try to make visual decisions based on, you know, what's really, really happening in the scene, and provoking a feeling in the audience just by the way the frame looks. And also the film is very referential. you know, my characters are very referential. I sound very pretentious by saying this, perhaps, but it's, you know, I embrace the sort of, you know, postmodern method of storytelling where films can sort of sometimes, you know, make reference to other films and make visual quotes to other films. And I had a lot of fun inserting some of that into this film as well.
So you and I were at a discussion last night, and there were students there from Paul Quinn College, and then the president of Paul Quinn College was there as well. And he was saying that one thing that frustrates him as the president of a historically black college and university is that that seems to be the only thing that people think he can talk about, the only interest he has, the only expertise he has. He's an educator. And I wonder if you have any concerns about that as like you're the next hot new young black filmmaker. And this is what people expect your entire oeuvre to be.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's sort of it's one of those things where it's kind of great until it's not great. You know, I talk about the Spike Lee thing.
When you're in control of it, it's great.
Yeah, and people have, you know, been comparing me to Spike Lee, which is incredibly flattering. And what I often say is that, like, you know, I don't want to necessarily be put in a box, but if I had to be put in a box,
it's not a bad box.
It's not a bad box to be in, you know. But it also, you know, it can kind of set you up for failure, because when it turned out not to be anything like Spike Lee with my second and third films, you know, people might feel disappointed. But I think I have to just keep doing what I did with this film, and it's telling the stories that are on my heart to tell, and saying the things that are on my mind to say, and not to sort of compromise in that way if I can, for as long as I can. That's the way I'm going to at least go after it. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Did you feel limited at all by, I know that you raised $50,000 like with crowdsourced funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
was that all the funding that you had to make the film?
No, thankfully, no. We raised $50,000, but what we really did is we built awareness, and we were able to amass an audience for a film that didn't exist yet, just off the premise of the film with the concept trailer I created for YouTube and an Indiegogo campaign. And we used that money to sort of do the preliminary things that you do. Location scout, hire people to sort of put together preliminary budgets so that you can pitch to the studios. We started casting. Kim Coleman was our amazing casting director out of L.A. Lynn Blumenthal did our local casting in Minneapolis. And so we were able, I really spent, you know, months and months sort of looking at actors for the roles, because that's kind of all we could do, you know, for a long time. But eventually Code Red Films came in, produced by the name of Julia Lebedev, and decided to finance the film based on the fact that we had such a, you know, audience who were just very, very excited, even though it had been 2 years since, you know, the concept trailer had come out.
Do you then, when you're in development for that long, do you have everybody under the sun telling you, and here's what you should do?
Yeah. You do. And there's people who want you to compromise. You know, I can't tell you how many times I had to shoot down the web series thing, you know, and there's nothing wrong with web series, but this was not a web series.
Right.
This is a film. And you know, that's how I wanted to do it. I didn't want to shoot it on my iPhone. And I think there's some beautiful movies that are shot, you know, in a lo-fi kind of way and use what you got kind of way. But there were certain compromises I wasn't willing to make to tell this particular story. And, you know, I'm glad I didn't, because eventually it worked out, but it did take it took some doing, and it took some, you know, sort of holding true to the vision of the film in spite of some offers that may have may not have realized the film in the best way.
We're speaking with filmmaker Justin Simeon. Dear White People, his new movie is out in theaters. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
The role of counterculture is to wake up the mainstream.
I have furniture older than you. Counterculture? Is that what you think this is? Your little show?
What about my show?
The show is racist.
Black people can't be racist. Prejudice, yes, but not racist. Racism describes a system of disadvantage based on race. Black people can't be racist, since we don't stand to benefit from such a system.
Your antics are making press, Sam. And press like this keeps men like President Fletcher up at night.
Warm milk?
He's building a file on you.
Okay, it's not my fault that your son couldn't beat me in an election.
I'm sure it was tough growing up, wondering which side you fit into. Feeling like you have to overcompensate, perhaps?
If that's true, Dean, I'm not the only one.
That was Tessa Thompson as Sam White and Dennis Haysbert as Dean Fairbanks in Dear White People. Filmmaker Justin Simeon is with us now, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. There is a lot in this film, a subtext about questioning loyalties and, and whether or not people need to pick a side in order to be authentically themselves or authentically part of the group, and maybe those aren't the same thing.
Yeah, I think I really loved playing, it goes back to this identity versus self, because kind of like we talked about last night, actually, is this idea that in American society, I don't think you can necessarily survive without an identity. I feel like it's very difficult to sort of meet one's potential without figuring out which community to anchor into. And then that's a very tricky thing to do and to sort of navigate, because ultimately I do believe that, the self is most important, and figuring out who you are and what you want out of life and, what's authentic to you is the most important thing to sort of figure out, particularly as a young person. But it's also impossible to get on, in American life if you don't have a place somewhere in a community and the sort of when to work for your identity and when to work for yourself. I think that's a tricky thing to figure out a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, is it even possible to find your way to an authentic understanding of yourself without holding yourself up for comparison to other people, whoever they might be?
Sure. I think it's a double-edged sword. I think it's sort of case by case situation. Even me, kind of choosing to tell this authentic story from my authentic point of view and all those things, now I'm a Black filmmaker, and I mean something different in the minds of some people than I may even think of as myself. And I oftentimes have these conversations with student activists that are grappling very real issues on their campus, and they're hoping that I will have like a very specific kind of game plan for them, and I don't, mm-hmm. because that's not necessarily my lane. My lane is telling stories, and it can be awkward because I want to be
right.
the version
right.
of myself that they want me to be sometimes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Virgil in Dallas. Hey, Virgil.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just like to congratulate the filmmaker on what he did, because you have to bring a more diverse voice to the cinema. And this is something that I think that white people just don't think about, because they don't have to. But it's good that you bring it up in a way that hopefully it'll get not just white people, but Black people and everybody just to think about this question. How do we interact with each other, and what way should we interact with each other if we want to bring about some deeper understanding?
Mm.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
You want to respond to there?
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm very hopeful that that's what will happen. We had a limited run last weekend that did very well in New York, L.A., Atlanta, D.C., and the diversity in the crowds was a really cool thing to see. I got so many messages from people all over the country saying, this is the most diverse group of people I have ever seen in the same movie theater. And the fact that they're having, and by the way, I think it's great. I love when... I love talking to Black folks that see the film, because their experience with the film is very specific. It's like, you were telling my story. Mm-hmm. And that is such a wonderful thing to see yourself in the culture. And I'm so, I find it so gratifying to have those conversations. But I am also glad, when the crowds are really diverse and you have people having cross-cultural conversations that maybe they never had before, and maybe they were afraid to have before. But because the film's a comedy, it feels like a safer space perhaps to have these conversations. And it's cool to see that happening. It really is, because before this movie, that was the big question on everyone's mind. Like, is that going to happen? Is everyone going to come out to see this movie? Who's going to come out to see this movie? And, in all honesty, say, like, everyone's coming out to see this movie, and it's a cool thing to see.
Last night, you and I participated in this screening, and then there was a discussion afterward with a very diverse audience, a very diverse panel up in front. And it occurred to me to wonder whether the conversation would somehow have been different if everybody on the panel were Black or everybody were white, and there was no sense of sort of being aware of the other, if you want to use that phrase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think certainly for a Black going audience and Black folks in particular, like, I think you're so struck by seeing something that is so true to your experience that has never really been articulated in that way. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the tone of the conversation, just because, I mean, I remember when I saw Medicine for Melancholy, which was filmed by a filmmaker named Barry Jenkins, and he told the story of the day after, you know, these two black people hook up, and they're in San Francisco where there are barely any black people, and they're just sort of having this awkward walk and talk, you know, it's really the only black mumblecore in existence, and I just remembered feeling like, oh my God, like someone captured that thing, you know, that's the feeling that my life has to it. That's the rhythm that it has to it. These are the kind of conversations I'm having. And even though the film is ultimately about other things, it's about love and it's about finding a place and it's about finding your person and it's about these bigger issues, you know, I was just so, you know, awestruck by the fact that anything that looked like my life was actually on screen. And I think that's a valid response to the film. But, you know, when we do have when I am talking to panelists or people who are white or of different races, you know, they're relating it back to their particular experiences, or they're sometimes opening up to the experiences that they never even considered, you know? I've had people say, I had no idea that that's what that feels like to be on the other side of that. And, you know, I'm so glad that now I know not to touch, you know, my coworker's hair when she comes in with a new hairdo or whatever the case may be. And oftentimes the revelations are more profound than that, but they're both cool. And I really enjoyed the diversity of our panel last night because, you know, it really did bring about some interesting perspectives. Like, I love hearing, you know, there was a woman from Brazil at one of my screenings, and she says, you know, my understanding of racism is very different than the American understanding of racism, but this film touched me and impacted me because of X, Y, and Z, and that's just so cool. That's just so cool.
One of your characters, Lionel, happens to be gay, and it struck me that this is something different about the millennials. So we see Lionel sort of having a crush on his editor, and his editor kind of has a crush on him. And I feel like when I went to college in the 80s, if there'd been a scene like that, even if people didn't harbor any particular animosity toward gay people, there would have been a reaction. And last night, the screening that I attended, there was a little bit of a, oh, I guess this is going to happen. But then after that, everybody kind of went with it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, it plays differently. I will say that. The kisses play very differently to different audiences. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know what, this is the world we live in, you know? And I think it's ridiculous that, like, the gay experience is so absent from black popular culture, especially, you know, the black male gay experience. And oftentimes when black men are portrayed in popular black culture, they're very exoticized, they're over the top, they're, you know, ridiculous. And by the way, there are plenty of fabulously ridiculous over-the-top gay black men.
But they're not the only ones.
But they're not the only ones. And I wanted to tell a story about a guy who was sort of stuck in the middle because he wasn't obviously anything, you know? Mm-hmm. He didn't feel even black enough. And he's obviously a black man, but he's a nerd. And he doesn't quite fit into, you know, the sort of social mores that are open for black people on this campus. And he also isn't obviously gay. And so where does he fit then? If he can't see a version of himself out there in the culture, that he's surrounded by, you know, he feels as if maybe he doesn't belong there. And I wanted to talk about that because that is never talked about. That particular aspect of the experience is never really dealt with.
That's fascinating because the question of him not being obviously gay. I mean, if you're black, you're obviously black. If you're white, you're obviously white. And there are, you know, clearly there are people who whose race and ethnicity may not be evident to everybody or people guessing correctly. Mm-hmm. But it's not something you can sort of choose to let people know or not. It's just out there.
Sure. But even, like, you know, for me, I remember the look on, I had a group of you know, white friends that were playing basketball, and they were so eager to get me to sort of, you know,
people really think that.
Yeah, but it wasn't rude or anything. It was just like, Justin, you know, please, you know, we need you. And I started playing. They're like, oh, we don't need you. we're good. Thank you. And it wasn't like they weren't trying to offend me or anything, but it's like, yes, I'm obviously black, but then that comes along with all these other assumptions that are just unfortunately not always true. And I think that, you know, I feel like Lionel, you know, he doesn't look like the other black kids on campus. He doesn't dress like them. He doesn't talk like them. He doesn't, you know, he's not into the same thing, or so he thinks. And I don't know. I wanted to talk about being in the middle because I think a lot of folks feel alone in that, but they're not. I think a lot of us are having that experience, even if maybe we're fronting and acting like we're not.
Well, Justin, this has been such a pleasure, and I just can't wait to see what you do next. So thank you so much for spending
this
time with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It was great.
Justin Simien's new film is called Dear White People. It's open now in theaters.